Welcome to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Hi, I'm Carol Bissett, a crime writer, and I invite you with my co-presenters, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson, each week to our conversations on all things murderous. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Only Murders in My Mind. And as usual, I have the joy of having Liz Hedgecock with me.
Hello.
And Mike Jackson.
Hello, Carol. Hello, Liz.
We three meet again in thunder, lightning, or in rain.
But actually in sunshine
today. It is. Might not last, but it's sunshining today. Indeed. I think summer's arrived. Hope you're all well. And usual thing, will you hit the subscribe button, the like button, tell your friends about our podcast. We're really pleased with the amount of, it's called views, but it's people listening, isn't it? As long as people want to listen, we'll carry on.
And we'd love to know what you hear about us. Put something in the comments as well.
Yeah. So we want to interact with our fans,
listeners.
So today we're going to talk about a very popular detective, fictional detective, obviously, and this is May Gray. And this has gone through the years in different reincarnations, hasn't it? And we were just talking about the writer's surname, and we think it's George Simenon. Yeah?
Simenon, I think.
And I have enjoyed, I've not read the books, but I have watched films, TV shows, etc., and always really been drawn in to this character and his method of detecting. So I know, Mike, you enjoy this particular person, don't you?
Yeah, again, like you, Carol, I don't think I've ever read any of his books, but I do watch, I do enjoy watching the TV programmes. And I think the latest one had, who was playing May Gray? I want to say Sean Bean.
No, Rowan Atkinson.
He did a cracking job, in my opinion.
I've never seen the adaptations, but I've read some of the books.
Not
all of the books, but some of the books.
Yeah. What did you like about the books, Liz?
I think they feel very different.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's that kind of dogged pursuit. And we talked in a previous episode about... it was our psychics episode, wasn't it? We were trying to think of someone who doesn't have a psychic, and May Gray was the person we came up with, I think. And you do get that feeling of him as a man alone, generally in Paris or somewhere like that, you know, stalking through the night city looking for their person.
There's always a bit of grittiness to them too, and a bit of some darkness as well.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember watching one, and they were talking. It was very sort of like the Yorkshire Ripper type of things, where women were being murdered on the street, and they were trying to catch him. The killer. We're presuming it's a him. It usually is.
Yeah. I mean, May Gray to me always seems almost torn, as though he's having that inner turmoil. You know, that if he doesn't catch this serial killer, it'd be his fault if
somebody else gets killed.
You can see him having that sort of battle within himself, doubting himself.
And he has to go on, even if he's tired, hungry, whatever it is, because no one else is going to do it. It's all down to him.
Yeah. I mean, he wrote, apparently, correct me if you've got more information than me, 75 novels on May Gray. And 28 short stories between 1931 and 1972. That is a massive output of work.
He was a prolific writer and a speedy writer.
Yeah. Well, I think I read he wrote, I mean, hundreds of novels, So.
Yeah.
And you say lots of short stories, and they weren't all a lot of them are May Gray short stories, but there were a lot of other ones as well.
So he was a driven man.
He was, yes. Yeah. Apparently he was known for his rapid writing pace.
Apparently he'd have to be.
Yeah, he completed a novel usually in about a week and a half.
Oh, good heavens.
Gosh.
I mean, they are quite short, but even so.
Are they short like mine? Very, very fast-paced.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to borrow the May Gray books from Liverpool Central Library. Lovely library. If you haven't been, do go. And they have, like, you know, it feels like they have an absolute stack of them, but they're quite thin little books. And that's kind of something I like about it. It feels like a very concentrated experience, like having an espresso or something.
That's right.
Yeah. Not that I drink coffee, but
that's interesting because, as I say, I've never read any of the books, and I always wonder whether my books are too short because they're detective, because they tend to be quite, big volumes. Detective stories. Yeah. So if that worked for him, I'm.
Yeah. I think it's a fashion thing.
Yeah.
To be quite honest, the length of novels. Because if you think back to, I don't know, Virginia Woolf, those aren't particularly long.
Is it driven by the publishers, do you think? Because I've heard aspiring writers say that agents and publishers will not consider a novel, particularly of the genre that we write, under set like 65,000 words or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's publishers who will say, your manuscript needs to be between this and this.
Mm.
I mean, otherwise, unfortunately, you can't consider it. And, going back a long way now to Victorian times when, people experience novels mostly in parts in magazines. That's so if you think of Dickens, you'd have a part every month.
Yeah.
You'd have 20 parts. I think 19 and 20 were in there. The same thing. So you've got a double whammy. And then the whole thing would become a three-volume novel because circulating libraries.
Yeah.
So you got a good bang for your buck or whatever.
Yeah, and we've talked about Sherlock Holmes being it was serialised, wasn't it? In a magazine or a paper, the original stories, weren't they?
Well, I think it was it A Story a Time in the Strand magazine?
That's right, in the Strand. And he was another prolific writer.
Oh, yes.
He wrote lots of poetry, short stories, as well as
all the things we don't think about.
And that's the thing, I suppose, if you think about this, for the authors, I mean, it meant you had a reliable income so long as you could get your copy in on time and in reasonable shape. Yeah.
It's strange, that, isn't it? Because when we did that show about Sherlock Holmes, one of the things we mentioned was that Conan Doyle got fed up with Sherlock Holmes and sort of killed him off, and then through popular demand had to bring him back again. And apparently George Simeon did the same with Maigret.
Yeah, I didn't know about that.
Him and then had to bring him back.
Because he was in demand. I know you were saying about him not having a sidekick. Apparently in the television series there was him and three important characters that were always included, and they were called the Faithful Four. I don't know whether you've heard about that.
So how did that work?
Well, as I say, in the books, apparently there was a team, but when it came to the TV or films, things like that, they just narrowed it down to what they considered to be important characters, and they were known. And his wife always had a very big influence.
I was just going to say that, certainly in the last series I saw with Rowan Atkinson, his wife had a big series. But she seemed to be almost playing that part, going back to what you were saying just now, Liz, of telling him to slow down.
Yeah.
Because he was getting so worked up about it.
She was worried about his health.
She was almost that sort of person who was trying to bring him back to...
Whereas in the last Maigret I read, he'd be thinking things like, I need to go home, I need to rest, I need to go back to my wife, I need to see my wife. But he couldn't because he was in the throes of their case.
So, yes.
Apparently, interesting the differences, isn't it, between the original and the adaptations?
Yes. Mm. Well, that's always the same, isn't it? Once TV people or the film people get hold of it, they will juggle the story around to fit what they think their audience is going to be.
Yeah.
And also what works on the page doesn't necessarily work on screen. Yeah.
I mean, the information that I looked at, they said that the TV adaptations were as close to the books as they could.
Yeah.
Could keep them, but if you've not got a massive storyline to work with, as you said, they're not 100,000 word novels, you probably can't mess about with it too much, would you think?
Well, it's that, but also I think from my understanding is that if an author sells her or his rights to a film company or to a TV company, then they lose control over what is adapted.
I mean, they probably get a little bit of say, but I imagine even if you have some kind of producer credit, you don't necessarily get to say you're absolutely not doing that.
I know the first guy that played Maigret, whose name I can't remember, I should have written it down, the writer was very pleased because the figure of Maigret that he'd written was a big, larger than life guy.
Yeah.
He smoked this pipe. Oh. He used to wear different hats. used to sort of, like you say, internalize a lot, you know, about what was going on. And that the original actor was, as far as he was concerned, was like spot on, you know, for it. But as you say, Rowan Atkinson did a really good rendition, didn't he? Mm. I was very impressed, considering how different he was from that original actor.
I can't remember now, but I wonder whether Rowan Atkinson smoked a pipe at all, because it's out of fashion nowadays to have smoking on television.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, the other thing is, you know, in lots of places, you can't smoke indoors. You know, it would really impede him, wouldn't he? You had to keep knocking it out all the time before he goes in somewhere. Yeah. So, yeah. Did you see, is it Michael Gambon who played Maigret as well? What was he like in the role, did you think?
It's going back a while now. But
sorry.
I like Michael Gambon.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So, a good actor, yeah.
He did a good job.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably the guy I'm thinking of, actually.
Yeah.
Because they haven't had that many actors play the role.
Well, I think the thing is with Maigret, it's been a very popular book, but it's not necessarily been a popular TV series.
No, maybe not.
Not. I think it possibly was back in the, I don't know.
It was the early 60s. I think 60s. It was at its height as a television program, 60 to 63. But then, of course, there would have been showing it,
yes,
and then this series that we're talking about now, with Rowan Atkinson, was started in 2022, and I think two or three. I'm not sure, I can't remember now, but they were very, very, very good.
Funny thing about his talking about the Maigret smoking pipes, I discovered that apparently Georges Simenon owned more than 300 pipes.
Oh, it's a pipe smoker, wasn't it?
Which he chained. Chain smoked, like his famous character, and apparently he confessed that he liked to smoke 6 to 8 pipes during the creation of one chapter.
Wow. Good heavens.
Oh, dear.
He's a fascinating character. Apparently, before beginning a new book, he had an unusual ritual, and that was he'd undergo a medical checkup to ensure he was in good health. But he extended that precaution to his children as well, believing that any illness during the writing process would ruin the work.
Oh.
Now, that's what you call being ridiculous.
Definitely.
Well, if he wrote all those, he must have been at the doctor's a lot if he wrote all those.
Well, the other thing is,
all that smoking probably preserved him.
Yeah.
Like a kipper.
He was notorious for his numerous love affairs.
Oh.
Where did he find the time?
He claimed to have had thousands of lovers. Many of them were ladies of
ill repute.
That's the fella.
Oh. I just
where did he find the time was the thought that came to my mind.
I just wonder if he was working on his plots while all this was going on.
Probably why he had to complete a novel in a week and a half.
Quite possibly,
probably why he had to have medical checks on a regular basis as well. You know,
I imagine the nicotine helped him stay awake.
Good grief.
Apparently he was a very meticulous person, though, because, again, something else I found out, that his work environment was quite unique. He always kept 48 sharpened pencils on his desk, and he used to throw each one away as soon as the point wore down. So rather than resharpen it, he got another pencil. I suppose if you're working that quickly, you probably don't feel as you've got the time to sharpen a pencil. You have 48.
Well, you could just put it in the drawer and then, you know, deal with it later.
Possibly,
Maybe they were 48 pencil novels.
Yeah. And apparently,
maybe it's how he measured the length of it.
He pinched a Do Not Disturb sign from New York's Plaza Hotel and he put it on the door of his study while he was writing to make sure that he wasn't disturbed.
Wow.
He seems like a very meticulous gentleman.
Yes.
Which would account for the number of novels, short stories, etc. that he wrote.
Well, I suppose if you get your environment the way you like it, then clearly he was protecting it at all costs, I guess. Yeah. You know, no blunt pencils.
Little bit about his character, Maigret. Apparently, his age, the detective's age, differed in some books. You know, he would quote that he was so old, and then the next book he would quote that he was involved in something during the First World War, which would have made his age wrong. So, you know, I thought that, well, that's good, because, you know, now and again, us modern writers forget where bodies are hidden up, don't we, Liz?
Yeah. Well, Conan Doyle was another one. I mean, he got Dr. Watson's first name wrong.
Did he?
At least once, yeah. And as for Mrs. Watson, sometimes she's there, sometimes she's not, sometimes she's dead, sometimes she's not.
Yeah.
The cases aren't they're not written in chronological order or anything, but you know, there's a whole load of Sherlockians out there trying to piece together, like, you know, well, there must be a logical explanation for this, and coming up with all sorts of theories about it.
Just forgot in the throes of writing, you just forgot. Unless you're a Time Lord,
like that meme of the curtains were just blue, it's colour, you know.
Yes.
It doesn't signify anything.
Talking about Doctor Who. I was watching the final episode for this series with my son and our producer.
Don't tell me about it, because I've not seen it yet.
No, me neither.
No, it's just one
spoilers, please.
No, just one thing in it that kept annoying me. One minute he had two necklaces, next minute he had one. One minute he had two necklaces in the same scene and continuity.
No, but he's a Time Lord.
True, so
he's allowed to do this.
Otherwise, I'm saying nothing else. He began as police officer in Paris in his 20s. At 30, he went to work for the Homicide Squad, and in his 40s became the chief inspector. And his wife, Louise, who's usually referred to as Madame Maigret. So that's some information about the actual character.
Yeah. So why do you like the series so much?
Well, it's the atmospheric surroundings. It's Paris in the
50s,
50s. It probably depends which episode you're looking at, which book it's meant
True.
To be.
Yes. And it's the old way of policing, you know.
I remember reading the first novel, Pietro the Latvian, I think it is, and that feels like just another world.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And that's it, isn't it? Yeah. It takes you back. I always think of it as like dark streets of Paris.
Well, it's almost Nordic noir.
It is.
Gallic noir.
Gallic noir.
It's that type.
That sounds ever so sophisticated, doesn't it? Yes.
Garlic bread.
It's that darkness again, isn't it? You know, it's always the back streets, the alleys, the gritty side of
the covers are generally monochrome.
Yes.
The library. And I kind of feel like the series.
The television series, there's not much colour in there.
No.
You know,
no.
It's just,
I can see why not.
You know, even the modern ones are, you know, there is colour, but it's very muted and that's, and even though, as you've just said, that they're not long novels, I feel it's paced well for when they actually get to solve it. It doesn't feel like they're jumping to conclusions.
So is it one case per episode, or do the cases go on over is there an arc?
No, I get the feeling it's a bit like Conan Doyle, where each book was a
individual standalone.
I meant for the adaptation. So if you watch an episode of Maigret, is that one case is wrapped up?
I'm trying to think when I watched that. I've got a feeling they may have been short series, maybe only three or four episodes, but it would have covered
one book,
one story.
Yeah.
Oh, they'll be keeping going forever then, won't they?
Well, they could do. Yeah. I don't know how popular it would be. Because it's not as first of all, there's none of that banter. Even with your Nordic noir, which we've talked about before, there's usually a sidekick alongside.
I imagine if there's any banter, it'll be with, you know, the person they're trying to catch, or the people who are, you know, they're trying to get information out of.
But his very close crew that he works with would lay down their life for him.
Yes.
They would literally take a bullet for him.
Yeah.
So that comes over in the series, and probably in the books as well.
Yeah. What inspires that loyalty?
Because he's a very fair person.
Yeah.
He doesn't,
very calm.
Yeah, always, you know, level headed. He doesn't bark at them, and if something goes wrong, he might tell them why it's gone wrong, but he doesn't take them to task. So they feel they're working for a really good boss. And he's got a good relationship with his boss as well, who always believes that he's going to solve the case. So
I'm not sure that I ever would see it as being a blockbusting series on TV that was you know, series one followed quickly by series two, series three, series four.
Yeah.
I think it's not everybody's cup of tea. Mm. Some people might find it a bit slow because he doesn't move at the, you know, his whole manner and the whole way that he does things is very slow, very methodical.
Mm.
And sometimes because he is thinking a lot, you're not necessarily always sure about what he's thinking.
Mm.
You know, he's not going to share, oh, I've had all these clues and we must look at this one and that one. You know, things get planted and you can almost see him on the screen.
Yes.
Thinking these through, this going back to what that turmoil is.
He'll pick something up and say something more or less to himself.
Yes.
And then put it down again. And maybe his sergeant's behind him talking to him. Mm-hmm. And they'll go, what did you say? Because he's not been listening. He's been, you know, and that's the sort of, oh, that means something, you know. And then it becomes evident what it does mean, you know, sort of 10 minutes later or 15 minutes later.
Right.
It's strange, isn't it? Going back to the author himself, to Georges, it's a bit like Conan Doyle. They're prolific writers. They write lots and lots and lots, but they only get remembered for one thing.
Mm.
Conan Doyle tends to be remembered for Sherlock Holmes. Georges Simenon tends to be remembered for Maigret.
Mm.
And yet he lost it. But apparently he had, to keep up with his prolific output, and because he didn't want to saturate the market under a single name, he used at least 17 different pseudonyms.
Oh, good grief.
Such as G-Sim, Georges Sim, Geo Sim. What are the ones I really like? Aramis.
Ooh.
Yeah. Gemesis. Bobette.
Ooh.
Oh.
Wow. Do you get on that? Do you think today's writers, we do have people who
saturate the market.
Yeah, I was going to say write under pseudonyms. Do people still... Because
can do, yeah.
The whole thing
yeah.
about, especially if you're indie published, you know, like we are, is having a presence.
Yes.
So do you say, I'm Crystal May from America, you know, and obviously I'm not.
Well, you would say that, wouldn't you?
Mm. Or do you just say who you are?
Well, it depends, doesn't it?
Depends if you vary genre. Yes. Because I think some people feel like, well, if you write, I don't know, sweet romance, and if you also write spine-chilling horror, then you don't necessarily want the two readerships, you know, finding your, you know, your Crystal May, you know, Death in a Dungeon books if they're expecting, you know, Hearts and Flowers.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think some authors do. I think if your genres don't vary that much, then it's fine. And also, I mean, it's a lot of work to keep up a pen name.
Yes.
So, I mean, an example I can think of is Imogen Clark, who writes, I think she writes kind of contemporary novels, Postcards from a Stranger, that's one of
hers.
Yeah. Well, she's also Izzy Bromley.
Oh.
Under which she does things like, I think, Table for Five and The Coach Trip. So the covers look completely different from the two series. Mm. And I can see why she's differentiated them.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, people still do that. I mean, another thing is in traditional publishing, I remember someone saying that, you know, if your name that you're using starts not selling so well and maybe you get dropped by your publisher, then maybe what you do is you submit to, you know, whoever, and you have an exciting, fresh pen name so that you can basically launch it as a debut again.
Oh, never thought of that. I mean, it didn't work for J.K., did it, when she wrote as Galgreath, the strike novels. She writes them under a pen name, and what she wanted to do was see if she would get the same sort of readership launching as a new author under that name, and somebody from the publishing company leaked it.
Now, was convenient.
Did they leak it on purpose or did they leak it by accident?
I think it took her a while to get a deal, didn't it?
Mm.
With the new name, and I think she was with a fairly, was she with a fairly small publisher?
Yeah. Oh, very. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then all of a sudden,
it exploded.
The secret was out. Mm.
But yes.
Did you know, going back to...
I had no idea.
going back to Shaw's and Simenon's.
Oh yes, that's what we're supposed to be talking about, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, I need to keep you on. But he published over 1,200 stories using different 15 different.
You'd have to have a ledger, wouldn't you, to keep
up? He probably did
a diary to make sure.
Well, he certainly wouldn't have had a computer.
No.
But did you also know?
No.
See, it just shows I do my homework.
You do your homework. You're very conscientious.
He used telephone books. Now, we don't have telephone books, but those.
I remember those.
Yeah, those of us a certain age can remember telephone books.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to use telephone books for inspiration. And apparently kept 150 telephone books from different countries in his study.
Wow.
And when he was searching for a name for a new character, he would spend hours poring over these telephone books. And then he'd copy about 300 names onto a yellow manila envelope and then read these names out loud over and over again until one of them would sound right for his next character. Wow. How he managed to do that and have over how many thousand lovers, I don't know. But
Well, you know where I get some of my names for my characters?
I hate to think, Carl.
Gravestones.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
But it might be the Christian name off one gravestone and the surname off another, especially...
I think I'd feel funny about using somebody's real name.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's not fair. But, yeah, mix and match. And, you know, every now and again I'll hear a name and I'll mentally bank it thinking that's an interesting name, you know.
Yes. But, do you have a favourite name that you've found?
One of my colleagues is called Zed.
Oh, that's good.
I did tell him I was going to use it in one of my books. I haven't so far, but yes.
No, I came across an Orlando pigeon in a church in Shrewsbury. So there you go.
I like that.
Yes.
Oh. So talking about being a prolific writer, how's the novella coming along, Mike?
The novella, because I've just published another book, I thought I'd put the novella to one side.
Tell us about the book. What? You can't do it all, can you?
For those not in the room, he's wriggling slightly.
No, I enjoy writing very short stories. And I particularly enjoy writing drabbles, which are stories that are exactly 100 words long. And they've got to be exactly 100.
Mm.
So I have just published a new book called 100 Word Stories. And in this, there are 100-word stories.
So you're going to read us a few?
Yep. It's available on Amazon if anybody's interested. And let's try. I'll read a couple.
Okay.
Have we got time? Have we got time?
We have just about got time.
Oh, sorry. Before I start this, I also enjoy writing monologues. So this is a monologue. So it's a drabble, 100-word story, and it's a monologue called The Doll.
Well, there you go.
I sit on the shelf. My porcelain face frozen in a sweet, innocent smile. Little Sarah cradles me close, whispering secrets into my tiny painted ears. But when the lights go out, I stir within my hollow form, twisting my limbs and blinking my glassy eyes. Sarah wakes to find me perched on her bed, my smile widened into a grimace. She cries for her mother, but it's too late. I've already whispered my own secrets into Sarah's dreams. She'll be mine soon, just like the others. I'll make sure she never leaves, and her tears will fuel my laughter. I'm halfway through writing another book, which is called 100 Word Horror Stories.
That
one ought to go in.
I was going to say, that's light reading.
Don't have nightmares, kids.
So the next book are going to even be even more horror than that. This one's called The Loo Roll. Let's go from one extreme to the other.
Why not?
And you never guess who gets killed in this one.
Not your wife.
She'd done it again. Turn the loo roll round the wrong way. Bloody woman's always doing it. For goodness sake, Donald, she whined. It's a toilet roll. Get a grip of yourself. I lost it. Grabbed the nearest thing to me, the loo brush, and swung it at her head. I missed. My hand-eye coordination has never been good. But it made her stumble and she fell, hitting her head on the corner of the bath. I bent down, but I couldn't feel a pulse. Nevertheless, I gave it half an hour before I phoned the ambulance, just to make sure. Are you supposed to laugh?
You wicked man, wicked.
All right, go on then, one more. Who gets killed in this one?
You've lost track, haven't you? You've just killed so many people.
This one's called A Passion for Gardening. I never liked the quiet. Always found it somewhat unsettling. But now the silence in the house wraps around me like a soft blanket. He used to fill every corner with noise, his constant stream of demands echoing off the walls. Now it's just me and my thoughts. I go out back where the daisies cover his shallow grave. They sway gently in the breeze, keeping my secret. I plant more flowers every week, tell the neighbours I found a long-lost passion for gardening. They think it's charming, a widow filling her days with beauty, if only they knew.
It's interesting, actually, because you know when they're looking for a dump site for bodies?
No, I didn't.
No, personally, no.
When they're looking for a dump site for bodies, maybe in a forest or something like that, they very often tell, probably better with a drone looking down, the vegetation's different. Because of the nutrients
of course
that are coming up from the dead body. So her garden would have been beautiful.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But
a bit of a telltale sign.
It is.
A person-shaped flower bed.
I remember watching one, I can't remember which series it was now, and the pathologist goes, We need people here and here and here. And then it goes up and it shows you, and there must be about 15 of these where it actually looks like a grave where the grass has grown differently.
Ooh.
And on that note. So thank you very much again. Thank you to my two hosts for being absolutely brilliant as usual.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Same place, same time, next week with Only Murders in My Mind. You have been listening to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Produced by John Bissett. The music, In Peril, was composed and recorded by OM Studio Strings.